why, and I thought maybe I'm getting off here, I thought that that was also a reason that we got into this discussion in terms of some kind of statement. Certain judges, we understood, we had one statement, some judges, incredible prose he uses. I won't name the judge where he's from, incredible prose. And maybe it's the prose that has the the prose board mesmerized, because they've never touched anything he's done. But aside from what the prose board does or doesn't do, Judge Hargreaves, the fact that some judges are apparently coming up with prose or a detailed statement, and others apparently aren't doing anything. I'm not saying, I don't know that, Your Honor. Should we do something about that? Prose board aside, get them out of it.
Prose board aside, no. Doesn't concern me.
So you don't think you should, if you sentence somebody, you don't think you should make any statement on the record as to why you're sentencing this person to the joint for so many years, as opposed to someone else who's convicted of the same crime, and you're not sentencing them to the joint?
Well, let me put it this way. If you, in fact, say, put the parole board aside, then I think the simple answer to your question is that's right. What purpose are you serving if you want us to make some sort of statement or finding? The only purpose that I can think of then is you're telling the defendant, well, I think you're going to pen for 5 years because this, that, and the other. That may be nice and may be informational for the defendant, but what have you accomplished? Anything? I don't think so.
But if the defendant is requesting the board to set aside the minimum.
Now, wait a minute. We're setting aside the parole board here. You can change the facts on me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. You understand? I'm moving a little different direction.
Excuse me. Okay.
I understand what your concern is.
Are publicly elected to the state of Oregon.
Right.
We do allow them a certain amount of discretion. You may more than you have or less.
Sure.
You look to your wisdom, whatever, in terms
whatever
of what you're going to do. From a public policy standpoint, public perception standpoint, nothing else, and we have to deal with that here. Shouldn't that be required?
Again, I guess the question that I have to ask you in return is, for what purpose does it serve?
I guess I'm not making my point. Okay, I won't continue
I'm not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Hargreaves, I understand your point of view, but it seems that one of the main things that I've learned this first session is that a lot of the problems seem to be because no one is looking at the criminal justice system as a system. Every part of it looks at their own domain and not seemingly concerned about coordinating with the other part. And I think that is what has engendered a great deal of misunderstanding and hard feelings between the DAs and the parole board and the judges in the parole board. And I think, at least in my view, in going along with this, was to try to bring the two things together. And I know that they may have a different perspective, but I think that the perspective that you bring from the trial is very important for the parole board. And as Representative Courtney mentioned, there are some judges that the parole board hasn't touched because they do provide that information. And I think we're going to continue to have a conflict between the different sections of the criminal justice system if we don't try to have some hookup between them.
Well, I guess if you're going to operate on the theory that you want to sort of meld those lines and so everything flows from one to the other, then I would agree with you that this material is the direction that you have to go. The problem that I have is that the legislature has said to us, Judge, essentially even now you're only making the in or out decision, and you may cap off the top right now, but it's the parole board who's going to determine how long that person stays there. What I'm saying is that if that's the direction that we're going, then let's draw me a nice clean line. I don't want to do the parole board's work for them. You let me make the in or out decision and let them go from there. I much prefer that to a sort of a washing together of their role and my role, and that's what I see is happening here. And I continue to be very concerned about the fact that as you do this, and the more you do this, you blur the lines between the judicial branch and the executive branch, and that concerns me a great deal. I disagree with that, and it's a philosophical disagreement that I have. I agree that if you want to do what you want to do, then you have to probably do it this way. The difference is, I don't think that's the way we ought to be going. We ought to be drawing clearer lines. If we're going to say one group is going to make the decision how long they stay in and the other group is only going to make the decision if they get there or not, then let's draw a clean line so we know what everybody's job is, and then we know what it is that I'm doing, we know what it is the parole board's doing, we know who's responsible for what decisions, and then if there are problems within that system, not only those who work with it, but the public also knows where to look and where to point the finger if they think there's a problem. And I think those lines should be very clearly drawn, and I see us not doing that.
Judge, I guess the thing is that I think we're probably all in a position that we wouldn't like to be in because of the overcrowding problem. And the fact is that, now let's focus on, to me, who's the most important, and that's the public. And they see the judge is sentencing, and because of the overcrowding problem, the parole board is having to let people out sooner. And what we have is a situation where the public is being deceived. Now, I wish that we didn't have an overcrowding problem, but we have not been honest with what we've been doing.
That's entirely true.
And the way we're trying to, we're trying to conform the system right now to the conditions that it's working under. And that's right.
Well, I guess in that regard, what I have the same concern, and I've said that for two sessions here, but it seems to me the way to solve that, or at least a possible way to solve that, is either for me to give a sentence and then for us to be upfront and honest about it on the backside, and you say, okay, parole board, don't consider your resources right now. Don't consider how many bed spaces you got. Figure out what you think an honest-to-God sentence ought to be for this person. Now, have a set of rules that say, fine, we haven't got space, so we're going to take 10% off all the C felons who only got one prior conviction or something. Right now, we've, again, run two things together, as Judge Boombrake was talking about earlier. We've run together the concept of what a sentence ought to be and what our resources are. Why not draw a line and say, fine, we recognize that a real sentence is this and this is what you're going to get, but we also know that we haven't got room for that many bodies, so this is a financial decision, folks.
Well, Judge, I guess the thing is, I think we're trying to ask you to at least help draw the line by giving more facts so that the parole board would say, the judge has drawn a line here, this is the case, this is the special case.
But if I do that, and that's fine, you know, we can do that, and we can find facts and tell whatever freezes over. And if those are the ones the parole board wants, that's fine too, but they're still not bound by them. They can make their own factual determinations, and it just seems to me to be really sort of strange that you tell me, first of all, not to get involved, and then you want to get me involved so that they can use my findings and say, yes, Judge, we agree with them or we don't agree with them. It seems to me that they ought to be making their own decisions on their own information. And we need that line between the two branches. And I don't think that's a philosophical thing that we're going to resolve between us.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Bill. Oh, Representative Garcia.
I've heard this described before. Do you think a judge has any obligation to take the position of an advocate for the sentence they've just handed out? Basically, be an advocate before the parole board, saying, this is what I did and this is why, and I'm arguing that it should stick.
I guess I'm not, well, maybe I'm clear, I'm not sure.
I've never heard of a judge, when one of the rulings is appealed, file their own friend of the court brief or something in the case, or they might want to. What I'm saying is advocating at the parole board level why you did what you did. You don't like the idea of, as I'm taking it, the parole board being up there above what you do. I'm saying if they are going to be there, that the judge, through one of these mechanisms perhaps, being an advocate for what they've just done, mandatory minimum.
No, I think that would be a totally inappropriate role for a judge to assume. And that's why, again, why I say, let's draw that line. I'm perfectly happy to just send them there and let the parole board do what they want to do with them. I'd be perfectly happy to have that line drawn. They can do whatever they care to do. I want my role to be defined, I want their role to be defined, and I don't want those two to overlap.
If you know an additional fact, when you sentence someone, such as you recall that they were before you 6 months before, and they indicated that their life was going to be changed, they'd never do again what they did before, and you gave them one last chance, and within that 6 month period they were caught for something new, convicted before you for sentencing, and you sentence them to the penitentiary, do you think that, one, would be helpful, or two, you had any obligation to let the parole board know about that particular fact you recalled that they might not otherwise learn about from the inmate at the penitentiary or the parole here?
Well, if that happens to be a thing at that time they're interested in, perhaps they'd like to have that. But again, I'm making my decision, I think, for different reasons than they are. And the fact that this person may have been before me 6 months before, or I may have told him that I was going to send him to the pen if he came back, so what? I'm using that to make the decision whether he's going to go to the pen or not. I'm not using that to determine how soon he's going to get out, which is on the other end of the scale.
Well, I mean, in the practice of law, I'm always trying to guess what's in the mind of a judge and what would make influence a judge one way or the other. I'm looking for signs and listening and trying to take all the factors into consideration. And I see you resisting trying to, I guess, make a determination or a guess or your professional judgment as to what the parole board might or might not be looking for.
Well, that's because I don't really care what the parole board is looking for. That's not my job, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't ask them to do my job, and I'm not asking to do their job. That's not my job, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, we're trying to tell you what your job is, I guess.
I understand that.
And so I'm trying to get information from you to figure out how to tell you how to do your job.
Well, I understand that. And I'm doing my best not to give you any openings that I can... and I don't intend to give you any that I can intentionally hold back on, because... I really disagree with the direction that you're going.
Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate your time. Mark Sisman?
Thank you for taking me out of order. I am an attorney at the Public Defender's Office in Clackamas County now. I formerly worked as a hearings officer at the Parole Board and worked with the board when the Advisory Commission was first meeting and adopting its rules. And also I've been serving as the chairperson of the Bar Committee on Corrections and Detention this past year. So some of my comments are directed from the position of the Public Defender's Office and some on behalf of the Bar Committee. A number of the attorneys have expressed concerns about the proposed amendment that Judge Hargraves has proffered, where the judge simply makes the in-out decision, and the net effect is that the sentence imposed is the statutory maximum. In the collective experience of the attorneys I've spoken to, there aren't a number of cases, I mean, frequently, where it's felt that where the judges impose sentences that are shorter than the maximum, where it does make a difference, where it has some effect on the prison term that's served even as, you know, that term is established by the parole board. And the feeling that the continued exercise of that judicial discretion in setting sentences shorter than the maximum is important and should be retained. Judge Hargrave's proposal, you know, strikes me as having some, or at least creating the impression to me of having some the sense of it really doesn't matter what sentence we impose, the parole board will do whatever it wants, and it sort of reflects what I have inferred as a great problem that many of the judges that I've heard have with the parole board's guideline system. The proposals in here to have the judges making findings is an important step, I think, in the direction of making the sense the judges have that, of what sentence is imposed or what action is taken in sentencing be more meaningful with respect to subsequent parole board action. It's important, I think, in the sense that you have that, to have that integration between the sentencing and the actual prison term that served for that overview of the system to work properly. The one thing that seemed to have been overlooked in the previous comments was that the parole board, through the advisory commission, has in fact made provisions for the judge's findings of fact to be binding on the parole board decisions. That was adopted by resolution, as I recall, at the advisory commission meetings. It was in effect written into the board's rules, although not as clearly as it might have been. Looking back, as the author of that, I can say that. Their rule 35-020 sub 2 sub b. In fact, if the judge does make specific findings of fact, historical fact about the circumstances of the offense, aggravation or mitigation, or facts that might affect, for instance, the person has a history of heroin or opiate derivative abuse, things like this, as I've seen the rules interpreted, would be binding on the board. The exceptions would be those cases where the judge says, this crime carries this offense severity rating, or this history risk score, and that is incorrectly stated. But the historical facts, by rule, are binding. Now, the one thing then that is missing, and that where it becomes important to clarify the language in this proposal, is maybe to say in section 2 that the judge should make findings regarding the circumstances of the offense, aggravation or mitigation, history risk score, that would be, for instance, that would be assisting the board, that would assist the board in setting the prison term or determine its sentence. And what should be added, I think, to address that concern is that any findings of fact that the judge makes at sentencing would then be binding on the parole board. And I'm talking about findings of historical fact rather than where you get into interpretations of how the rule would be applied. Now, perhaps that could be tied into then section 16 and section 17 of the proposal, where you're asking a certain information be submitted to the parole board. In section 16, then, you could simply ask that the findings of fact, any findings of fact that the judge may make, or any reasons for the sentence, which are already by statute mandatory for the parole board to consider, shall be submitted to the board. That perhaps would take care of the problem created by Smith versus Board of Parole, and avoid the obligation of sending material that may be redundant or may not really address the issues that the parole board will have to consider. Those findings of fact, as Representative Lombard, I think, pointed out, are particularly important when the judge does choose to impose a minimum sentence. Now, if this proposal for the minimum sentence is adopted, that might not really be necessary because it's not anticipating the minimum going above the guideline range. I have represented a large number of people before the parole board where minimums have been imposed, as well as other attorneys at the public defender's office. And it's been our experience that the cases where the judges do not support mandatory minimums with findings of aggravation where it exceeds the guideline range have been the cases where those have been overridden. The aggravated kind of situation that Judge Bonebrake referred to is actually contemplated in the operation of the rules as it operates now. You know, if you take that case he was referring to where carried a 40-year sentence with a 20-year minimum, you know, the range isn't simply the 60 to 80-month range. If the person's convicted of more than one offense and consecutive offenses are imposed, the range then becomes different, as you know. The range increases from 60 to 80 to 90 to 120. And if the aggravation that the judge has considered in that case is cited and the findings are made, even without a mandatory minimum, the board would be bound by those findings, and the rules operate in a way that the aggravation just that the board could impose would increase the range to a top of close to the 20-year minimum that it's already, you know, that the judge was referring to. With that proper integration of the judge's findings and the operation of the parole board rules, I think the system can continue to work well. The problem, as you've expressed, has been one of public perceptions, and a lot of it has, as I see it, and the concerns you've raised has been exacerbated by that juxtaposition of your indeterminate sentencing system that the judge has been accustomed to imposing, an indeterminate sentence of up to 20 years, with a guideline system which is based on meeting out a prison term based on a punishment commensurate with the crime. They're different philosophically, and in that sense, to continue to talk about just making a decision, this person can't be rehabilitated and we're going to send him to prison at the sentencing level, or say we're sentencing you to prison, the maximum on this is 10 years, 20 years, or whatever, may only continue to create that difficulty. And so I think encouraging the findings at the sentencing level, where there will be some more correlation as far as what the prison term is going to be, where it can be anticipated, may help to alleviate that, and certainly may help for the judges to become more immediately involved in seeing what the prison term will actually be. Along those lines, and in integrating the various aspects of the criminal justice system, the advisory commission composition, I would have one suggestion, and that is, in one of the proposals, it was suggested that other members be added to the commission. Originally, when the commission met, members of the district attorneys or attorney general's office and the defense bar were included as ex officio members, as advisors, such as the director of the corrections division. They added, and I think, an important role, as I saw it, as somebody working with the commission at that time. And I would suggest that perhaps the additions of a representative of the district attorney's office around the state, the defense bar, may be very important to add different perspectives to the commission and integrate different views from the criminal justice system. As far as Section 7 goes, involving the completion of the pre-sentence investigations, the Corrections and Detention Committee looked at that to some extent, felt that it was important and supported the concept of accelerating the timing on the pre-sentence investigations, but with a certain caveat that we need to raise. That is that very often there are serious mistakes in the pre-sentence investigations. There's no real means right now for correcting those errors that may come up and have them become official parts of the record. For instance, we may raise it at sentencing. The judge may even recognize that there is a factual error in the report, but that doesn't get written into the pre-sentence investigation that goes on through the system. I'm concerned that in 20 or 30 days, the necessary information will not always be or accurately convey that there will be a lot of errors. And so we would suggest that you consider the Senate bill that was 383 that called for correcting provisions for correcting errors in pre-sentence investigation to become a part of the official record, be considered if in that section, added to that section as a means of addressing what is a potentially serious problem. I'd next like to address aspects of this bill dealing with the timing on the warrants and the probation violation matters and also the hearings on parole revocations. The Bar Committee, the Public Defender's Office, share the support for limiting the warrants in the probation revocation area, setting the 15-day time limit. There's a disparity that I see written into the sections 20 and 21, providing for the 15-day time limit for the hearing on the parole revocation and the 15-day determination by the judge to issue a warrant that I think is probably somewhat inappropriate. Both parole and probation revocation hearings have, under the United States Supreme Court decisions, have been provided with precisely the same procedural due process protections. That does not appear to be written into the way the probation revocation hearings are provided for here and the arrest warrants are provided for and the way you're doing it in the parole revocation area. The decision of Morrissey versus Brewer is very closely adapted to the parole revocation area. The corresponding case, Gagnon versus Scarpelli, is not paralleled in the probation revocation area. What you've done is allow the corrections officer to issue a warrant. The judge then substitutes a warrant within 15 days. The hearing is to be done as soon as possible. There doesn't have to be that same probable cause finding to detain the person in the probation revocation area. At least it's not written in Section 20 the way you've written that into Section 21 on the parole revocation area. Yet the procedural due process requirements are the same in both, that you're supposed to have that hearing, preliminary hearing to determine probable cause to hold the person as soon as practicable under both those cases and in each area. As far as the time frame would go, I would say this. As a former hearings officer, the 15-day period is not one which is very practicable for the parole board as it exists now. It relies too much on the corrections division staff to get the papers advising the parolee of notice of the hearing and rights, then get that information back to the board, and then schedule a hearing for that to be done within 15 days. Because we have a unified hearing procedure where there's only one evidentiary hearing held in Oregon, the hearings officer then handles the entire hearing, and that, in effect, would have to be moved up within 15 days. It was hard to do that when I was there and there were two hearings officers. There are now only one hearings officer because of budget cuts, so it becomes more difficult. I challenged, as an attorney in private practice, the time limits in habeas corpus hearings on when a preliminary hearing must be held. In parole and probation violation hearings. The research that I did indicated that 15 days was the quickest time period that I found required anywhere in the United States, and that was by statute, as I recall, in Pennsylvania and under the U.S. Parole Commission rules. In the cases that dealt with that, it generally held that 30 days was the optimum reasonable period. There were some that held that 60 days was as much, maybe okay, but generally the weight of authority that I saw was that a period of about 30 days was acceptable for holding the preliminary hearing. As a defense attorney, I would like, of course, to see the people have their hearings as, you know, within 15 days. As a practical matter, I share with you my experience as a parole board hearings officer. I don't know that that can be done. I think that constitutionally that a 30-day time period would be acceptable. I would like to indicate, as far as from the Corrections and Detention Committee perspective, Section 27 is one which is very consistent with the Bar Committee's position as looking for alternatives to incarceration, and supports that. Finally, I just want to address Section 28, which limits the appeals to the Court of Appeals from, and actually eliminates it where a guilty plea has been entered. The concern that I have in that area is that while there may be little substantively to appeal, there are some instances such as restitution orders, conditions of probation, which currently may be appealed. As I read this, those matters would no longer be appealable under that particular section. I've